Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name is Robert Johnson, and as always tonight I'm joined by a man who didn't slam me, he didn't bump me, he didn't nudge me, he rubbed me. And Robin's son is racing. Yes, it's Christopher Webb.
There's nothing I can't do with a podcast, I'm telling you.
How are you, sir?
I'm crap. I've got tennis elbow.
Wow.
I know, it's still a thing.
Really?
Yeah, I thought it was a thing of the past, like Veruca socks and things like that. But no, I have tennis elbow.
I mean, I would have picked you for someone who's got athlete's foot, but I didn't want to say anything.
No.
But, tennis. So how do you get tennis elbow?
Not by Glenn Tennis, obviously.
No.
It's like a twisty army kind of thing. Feel free to make up your own jokes, listeners.
Is it your right arm or your left
it's
arm?
It's my right arm, yeah. It's my utility arm, yeah. Bloody sore. It really hurts.
What do you do for that?
I've got to do these funny little exercises like physio and medication. Mm. And I'm not allowed to use my right arm as often as I did at work, which is kind of fun.
Or at home.
Or at home, even.
You poor bugger.
I know. What about you? You okay? Enjoying this gorgeous Hawke's Bay weather?
Oh, we've got some shocking weather at the moment, haven't we?
We're in floods, listeners. It's flooding at the moment.
It is flooding.
Yeah.
I'm okay, although I do have to pay tribute to... We had a bit of a loss in our house a couple of weeks ago. We lost our dear old dog, Zoe.
Yeah, podcast dog.
Passed away. Died suddenly in my arms.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a shock. We love you, Zoe. But
I love Zoe. I thought she was lovely.
That's the first time I haven't had a dog since 2009. Mm. So it's really strange.
Yeah. But luckily my dog Holly is here to keep you company.
It was lovely.
Except she's blind and deaf.
She still recognised me.
She did actually, yeah.
She's the Helen Keller of dogs. Anyway.
Speaking of things not being able to hear and listen, we're not alone.
Are we not alone?
We are being listened in on once more.
Oh, I thought I could feel someone doing a bit of a slingshot manoeuvre in my ear.
Indeed, yeah. So we are joined by the racing commentator, Jake Sanson.
Jake, hello.
Hello there. It's great to be a guest on the show. I've listened to quite a few now, so it's been really, really nice to be invited in.
Oh, it's fantastic to have you join us. And it's whereabouts in the world are you at the moment, Jake?
So at this moment, I'm in Portimão at the Algarve International Circuit in Portugal. We're preparing for the FIA Karting European Championships. We have a warm-up race this weekend, and then 2 weeks from now, we have the first round of the European Championships. So it's where all of the current great stars of Formula One came from. So Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen, Lando Norris, Charles Leclerc, they all came from this paddock. So it's a pretty momentous opportunity for these youngsters to work their way up the motorsport ladder.
Fantastic.
It's brilliant.
And so, how long have you been in the motorsport commentary biz?
So this is my 11th year that I'm starting now. So I started at the age of 25 and I'm about to turn 36. And I've been doing pretty much everything in the world of motor racing at one stage or another over the last 10 years. I've done one Formula One Grand Prix, which was the British back in 2019. I covered the Le Mans 24 Hours 3 times.
Wow.
I've done a Formula E race. I even commentated for British television for IndyCar at Mid-Ohio 4 years ago. The only thing I haven't done so far is NASCAR.
I guess tonight, in a way, you could be doing a bit of NASCAR.
That was a beautiful segue. We can tell you're in the business. That was really impressive.
As with all our guests, we gave you the opportunity to choose a movie for us. And you threw a few options our way. And Chris and I kind of nudged you in a certain direction. What... rubbed you, if you will. Yeah. What
rubbed me in the direction of Days of Thunder?
Hold on a minute. Don't you think we ought to talk?
What, about how I'm going to run? Sure.
About how you've managed to live as long as you have.
Think you can drive?
Oh, he can drive. He can drive beyond the limits of the tires, the engine, the car, anything else.
There's nothing I can't do with a race car.
Well, that's the difference between you and me. There's only so much I can do.
You want me to work the pit and you drive?
You running good? Thank you. I will see how you do in the crowd. I was desperate to get your attention.
Well, you got it. I've walked into a jungle.
Come up here and do it. I'll take you to a race.
Really, I can't. I'm a doctor. I'm cool.
Think your driving can't improve?
I'll take your word for what a car can do, but I'm not taking anybody's word for what I can do.
See, a driver gets his bell rung and a couple of lights flicker. And loses what he needs more than his eyesight, more than his reflexes, more than anything in the world.
I've raced with my legs broke, heart bruised, eyes popping out of my head like they're on springs.
He loses his need. The need to drive right out there on the ragged edge.
He doesn't believe you can drive anymore.
How long before you find out if you're really good?
You just want to race again.
Oh, you're really lucky.
You get back in that car, you'll die.
I think it's one of the very first racing movies that I ever saw. It's a hobby of mine, is collecting racing movies. So because I'm in the motor racing industry and because it's my first love, it's the kind of movie I collect. So basically any form of movie that involves racing cars at a certain level, I will collect. So you name it, I've probably got it in my collection. So Grand Prix with James Garner, directed by Joan Frankenheimer.
Brilliant.
Steve McQueen's Le Mans is in my collection. So is the bizarre Wachowski brothers' interpretation of Speed Racer. Everything is in there. All of the Love Bug movies, which is a topic for a completely different podcast, but I absolutely adore it. That's my dream car, by the way. But the thing that I adored about Days of Thunder was that it was a Hollywood epic that people who didn't know anything about racing cars could get into.
Yeah.
And it was the first one. Recently, we've had Rush, which is Chris Hemsworth and Daniel Brühl as James Hunt and Niki Lauda, which again does what Days of Thunder did very well, which is tell motor racing to a non-motor racing audience, which is what I like about it. But there's something about Days of Thunder. Some critics described it as Top Gun on wheels.
Yeah.
It's pretty accurate, really, because obviously it's Tom Cruise again. What I like the most about it, I think, is that many people forget that Tom Cruise actually wrote it.
It's
a story that he actually wrote. And it, we have this idea of Tom Cruise as this sort of cult cliche figure. Oh, he's a little bit odd. He's a little bit weird. But he's immensely more talented than people give him credit for.
Mm.
And I think Days of Thunder was one of the first movies where we really got to see exactly how immense his talent actually is. I mean, yeah, the movies he'd done before that really kind of started to scratch at the surface of that. You think of movies like Risky Business, and you start to see things like Top Gun, obviously, and then you kind of get a sort of a flavor in Cocktail about, you know, how good he is. And then Rain Man. With Days of Thunder, there was like more to him than just going on set and reading lines.
Mm.
You know, he had a real depth of feel to him. I think it's actually one of his better acting performances as well.
Because he got the idea for this with Paul Newman, didn't he? Paul Newman sort of took him for a bit of a burn around the track.
Okay.
And he said, oh, we've got to make a movie about this.
This is the strange thing. Many people don't know just how good a driver Tom Cruise actually is.
Mm.
So Paul Newman in the late 80s, he was really into his motor racing after he did a movie. It's funny. So many Hollywood actors get the bug for racing cars after dabbling in a movie of it. So James Garner was completely smitten after he did Grand Prix. Steve McQueen, he had to make Le Mans because it was the only thing that he hadn't done was a racing movie. Paul Newman did a film in 1969 called Winning, which was around the Indy 500. And that's one of the greatest movies about cars you're ever going to see. And people have forgotten it, which is a real shame. Yeah, he started going racing while he was acting, and it was his thing. It was his hobby. It was his passion. He and Joanne Woodward would tour around the circuits all around America. And he competed in the SCCA, which was the Sports Car Club of America. He just happened to bump into Tom Cruise one day and said, well, why don't you come and join our race team for a couple of races? And secretly, Tom did actually go racing, and he was good.
Yeah.
He was a really, really good racing driver. And the more races he competed in and the better he got, the more terrified the movie executives and the insurance companies were. It's like, he's going to get really good at this, and we're suddenly going to have this situation where we've got a multi-million dollar budget movie to make, and he's going to be out cold.
Yeah.
So they basically put a stop to it. And it's one of the funny things about this movie, which is all about NASCAR, and he's the main protagonist. He wanted, being Tom Cruise, to do all of his own stunts.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to do all of his own driving. And the exec said, no, we're not going to let you take that risk. But I think ever since then, he's always had it written into his contracts because he was so frustrated that he couldn't do his own stunts in Days of Thunder. I'm fairly sure that that was the movie that he's now had it written into his contracts that he will now do all his own stunts. I'm not sure if that's true or not, if it was Days of Thunder that started that. But I'm fairly sure he was so frustrated that as a result, now he does all his own stunts in his movies. So Days of Thunder actually has quite an incredible legacy.
You'd have to imagine it sort of kicked off that bug that he's now got for performing his increasingly outlandish stunts in each film.
Yeah, well, he is widely regarded now as one of the best stuntmen in Hollywood. Yeah. So whatever he does turn his mind to, he is exceptionally good at it. And you're right, Jake, you know, there's all the jokes about, oh, Scientology, oh, he's a bit weird, he's a bit whatever, but... Mm. I'm stealing this from another podcast. Tom Cruise makes a really good Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. He makes a great
Absolutely.
Movie.
And I think he's become more interesting where his films have become less diverse because now he's effectively an action star. A lot of his films are action movies or whatever. This is a long way from when he was chasing an Oscar, if you like. Now he's kind of given up on that and now he just wants to go out and have a great time and be really, really entertaining. And obviously the best examples are the Mission Impossible films, which I just absolutely love. I think they're so good.
They are the best, you know, spy action blockbusters that are being made in Hollywood.
They're what the Bond films should be.
I kind of agree with you, actually. Yeah, I kind of went recently and watched the Daniel Craig Bond movies because I'm quite one of these people. I love my movies, but I'm quite slow to them. I don't dash down to the cinema to watch something brand new, which I should. But the Daniel Craig movies, yes, they are more Bond for me than some of the others because I also read the books. So I think Daniel Craig kind of nailed Ian Fleming's original interpretation of Bond. But the movies themselves, they kind of feel like, well, these are the boxes we've got to tick to keep the studio happy.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get a proper vibe of Daniel Craig for any of the Bond movies after Casino Royale.
Yep.
With Casino Royale, I felt they nailed it. With every film since then, I think they've been trying so hard to get back there that they've kind of missed the point. With Mission Impossible, you know you're in for a stupidly outlandish and bizarre action movie. Yep. You know that some of the stuff in there isn't going to make any sense. You know that the stuff out there has spent ridiculous quantities of money to set something up that just would never, ever happen. But that's the point.
Yeah.
That is literally the whole point. You're there to watch an action movie to be taken out of yourself. It's great fun.
And you know Tom Cruise is going to do at least one death-defying stunt. Daniel Craig, bless him, is just not going to be able to.
He hurts his knee and things like that, doesn't
he? He hurts his knee, yeah. You know, Tom Cruise breaks his ankle and still keeps going.
Yeah.
You know, I agree with you, Chris. You know, that the more I think that Tom Cruise has sort of honed his Tom Cruise-ness, certainly commercially, and from a stunts and spectacle perspective, you can't argue with it. But we do have to remember as well that the year before this film came out, he was Oscar nominated for Born on the 4th of July. He's done some fantastic acting performances. I mean, Magnolia is one of my favourite performances of his. So this is a guy who can really act. He's just a force of his own now, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He's... I'm trying to think of the word for it, but he's like an entity in his own right, if that makes sense, rather than just he's a thing.
I'm a Cruise fan. I try and sort of divorce the wacky Scientology stuff and the things that you hear.
Everyone's allowed a personal life, right?
Everyone's allowed a personal life. I like to think he's a victim in that situation, as much of a... as anything else. Looks he's being likely, exploited. Yeah. I just think, for entertainment, for sheer committed performances, like, he never phones it in.
That's true.
So, Days of Thunder...
Mm.
Now, Jake, did this in any way inspire you to get into your chosen field of work? Or
I suppose it did. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of when I first watched this, I would have been about 10 or 11, so a lot earlier than I should have done because it's a 15 in the UK. But as far as I was concerned, it was a racing movie, so I was going to watch it. I can remember vividly, you know, there were a couple of racing movies on that night, and it was to celebrate the start of the Formula One season. So it was Days of Thunder was one of them. And I think the other one was Checkered Flag, which was a very dodgy film pilot starring Rob Estes.
Oh, wow.
Thank goodness it has never seen the light of day since, because that is genuinely the worst movie probably that's ever been made. And thank goodness it's been cast into the spirit of oblivion. Anyway, moving on. Days of Thunder, the thing I like the most about it is that it does kind of give you the essence of what the sport is about.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't lie about what the sport is. It goes very deeply into the whole thing that, you know, if you haven't got any money, you haven't got a career. It's as simple as that. You really have to live very selfishly. You have to be incredibly driven, phenomenally focused, and you cannot let outside forces deviate from your brain pattern of thought. And that's kind of the thing I was into as a kid. I really wanted to be a racing driver. I didn't want to be a broadcaster at all. I wanted to drive, but because I had no money, it was never going to happen. So I kind of lived vicariously through the Hollywood movies about racing that I was watching at the time. And Days of Thunder was a really accurate one. You know, there are certain movies that you watch now and you sit there and think, yeah, this is completely phony and unrealistic. Hollywood has dabbled in this and ruined it. I'm looking at you, Sylvester Stallone, with Driven. actually, to be fair, I don't blame Sylvester Stallone so much as Rennie Harlin. Nobody should ever give Rennie Harlin a film project to direct. I mean, Deep Blue Sea should have told the world that he cannot direct a movie for Toffee. Anyway, but yeah, for me, the good racing movie is about realism. It has to be realistic. I know people who love cars love Fast and the Furious. I hate it. I hate it with an absolute passion. The whole saga, every single film that has Fast and the Furious over it, I will not own it because it's just...
You didn't think a car going into space was
Well, I think if it was realistic, then it probably would have happened in 1971 when the dude played golf on the moon at the same time. You know, I don't think... I'm not so sure there's a market for cars going in space. Well, maybe Elon Musk has a different view. But I do find that, you know, if you're going to tell a story about racing, you have to tell the world the story about what the world is really like in racing.
Yeah.
You actually have to tell it well. And Days of Thunder was, I think, one of the very first movies, certainly in the modern era, that told it really, really well. And we've been waiting for quite a while, I think, for a movie that got that close to the sport and told the story genuinely. Grand Prix was 1966. Winning was 69. Winning was 1970. And we had waited a long time for a movie that really got there. And the best known NASCAR movie up to that point, I think, was Stroker Ace with Burt Reynolds.
Yeah. We've discussed that one here.
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I like it to a certain extent, but I think the thing I like the most about it is just how on board the NASCAR folk were with it. I mean, fair play to Dale Earnhardt for actually being a sport and getting on with it. So fair play.
Burt Reynolds, of course, makes a vocal cameo in this film.
Does he?
He does indeed.
He announces the final race, doesn't he?
I've known when you're Ian Exposition, like the commentator at Daytona.
He just says one line, I think.
Okay.
One line, one line. It's very, very, it's one of those weird random facts about Days of Thunder that not many people are aware of. In the same way that this was the movie that gave Margot Martindale her first ever appearance in a Hollywood production of any kind. She was the time scorer during the test session. And she's gone on to do some fabulous, fabulous comedy stuff since then. 1.7 seconds, I think, is her total airtime in this movie. But she's there, and you have to double take. I'm like, is that Margot Martindale? It is.
So, Chris, you've obviously got some history with this film.
No, I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it? Yeah, no, I haven't seen it
either.
I've
never seen it before. Confess.
Oh, guys. It's one of those films you literally have to spare an entire evening. About 2 hours to recover from it afterwards.
I just was never... It never appealed to me as a kid. I was a huge Top Gun fan. And so I was 9 when this came out. And all I sort of remember about it was that this is where Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise met and fell in love. And,
yes, it is.
I remember the Mellow Yellow sponsorship on his suit. And I liked Mellow Yellow. And I remembered Maria McKee... Was it Maria?
Maria McKee.
Making Maria McKee's Show Me Heaven. I think it charted quite well.
It did number one in the UK. Yep.
No pun intended. It was too grounded a version of Top Gun. And it didn't appeal to me. Top Gun had that kind of baddies and goodies and guns and that kind of action that I was interested in. And as a kid, I didn't really know anything about NASCAR. And it kind of just passed me by.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I was older than 9 when it came out. I was 19 when it came out. I must have seen the trailer for this about 100 times because my dad had hooked up Sky illegally on the roof. And the trailer for this was always on Sky Movies, constantly. Yeah. So I could probably recite the trailer for you right now. But same as you, it never really appealed to me. I don't really know why, because I was probably about the right age to go, oh, great. I was trying to be a bit too cool and, oh, Days of Thunder, it's another Tom Cruise film.
Yeah.
So maybe I was a bit sniffy. Which, you know, it's not like me at all to be a snob, as you know.
How unlike
no.
you.
No. But I don't ever recall... It must have been on TV loads of times, but I don't ever recall it being on telly. So I was really pleased you chose it, because it's one of those little curios. I thought, well, I must get around to watching it at some point. And you're right, there are those comparisons with Top Gun, mainly because of the cast and the director.
And the producers.
And the producers.
Yeah.
But I think it's more just following a formula of a certain type of film, of which Top Gun is one of them.
Yeah.
You've got the young, arrogant maverick. You've got the almost Mr. Miyagi-style mentor. You've got the best friend who, will he die, won't he? He's got these issues in the past that he needs to get over. That didn't start with Top Gun. Top Gun just happened to be of that type of film. So I think it was just, say, unfortunate for Days of Thunder that it followed so closely after Top Gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, people refer to it as Top Car and things like that. So
they do, yeah, they do. I mean, it's a fascinating slight deviation from that. You've certainly got the Mr. Miyagi thing with, you know, this incredible plot about a guy who is one of the best team principals in the sport, Harry Haug, played by Robert Duvall, who basically is dragged back by a very intense car dealer, Randy Quaid. Yeah. Oh, I adore Randy Quaid. He's just one of my favourite guys in Hollywood. I love Randy Quaid. And
he's gone a bit weird now, hasn't he?
So there is a fabulous line that could only have been delivered by Randy Quaid, where he chastises the team. Cole Trickle, played by Tom Cruise, and Harry Hogg, played by Robert Duvall, have instigated a fight in the pit lane. And Randy Quaid chastises them by saying, "What do? We end up looking like a monkey fucking a football out there." It's so beautifully uttered.
Apparently that was the first time in a PG-13 film that you were allowed to use the term fuck in the context of sex.
Do you know, I think it was. Yeah, I genuinely think it was the very first time. Because the thing is, it's so perfectly timed. And I think it's the only mention of that word in the whole film.
It is.
I don't think it ever comes up again. So it's just the shock factor. It really grounds the viewer at that point. It's like, oh my goodness. Did he just say what I think he said? And it's never mentioned that word ever again.
And it immediately conjures up the mental image of it happening too. Well, it did for me anyway.
It did for me too. I started trying to visualise.
And I didn't know if it was like an association football or an American football. Yeah. Actually, I was trying to work it out.
Yeah, I was thinking he's laces out or...
But yeah, what was really interesting about the way this was done, dissimilar to Top Gun, is that the hero, Cole Trickle, Tom Cruise, he is tortured in a way that is not really redeemable. You know, he's not a very likable guy at the start. He's just naive. He's just wet behind the ears. And he's a bit stupid, actually.
Yeah.
He's not a particularly smart character. He needs to kind of grow up and figure out, you know, what he needs to do.
I've written that he's Maverick without the subtlety and nuance.
That's absolutely it. That's a really good description. He kind of reminds me of, this is showing my weird, diverse knowledge of movies, he kind of reminds me of Kale in Titan A.E., one of the great Joss Whedon projects.
Okay, yeah. Is it Matt Damon's character? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He thinks that he's really, really impressive, but in fact, he's actually a bit of an idiot.
Yeah.
And he kind of needs to grow up and figure out what's going on in the world. And that's kind of what you get with Tom Cruise. And I don't think it's really until he meets Dr. Claire Lewicki, Nicole Kidman's character, that he actually starts to do that. You know, he kind of sort of subtly figures out that, you know, I need to be a little bit more mature here. But it's not until he meets her that he actually realizes, well, I might have something going for me here. It's from that moment on. He completely transforms his character.
Yeah.
He changes.
It's interesting that Cruise and Robert Towne have written his character to be flawed. I mean, normally you think, oh, Tom Cruise, he's this great hero. He's brilliant. He's perfect at everything. But he's written himself with it's real hubris. He thinks he's fantastic. But it takes half an hour for him to go, sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know what to do.
I really enjoyed that scene.
Yeah.
It's quite a trend amongst racing car folk, amongst racing car people, because the thing is that the machine is king. Everybody remembers the cars, how beautiful they are and how fast they are. To remember a driver, they have to be sensational. They have to be spectacular. You've got to look at this from the point of view of, you know, the names that we remember are not the boring ones. You know, we remember people like Schumacher, we remember Senna, we remember Earnhardt, we remember Jeff Gordon, we remember all of these incredible stars over the years, but there was something special about them.
Mm.
And that's what every racer is trying to aspire to. And at the beginning of the film, that's what Cole Trickle is desperately trying to aspire to. He's trying to be spectacular. He's trying to be sensational. He's trying to be a superstar, and he has no idea how to go about it. Yeah, it's very intelligent writing to not cast yourself as the hero. Steve McQueen did exactly the same thing in Le Mans. You know, he believed himself to be the best. But if you actually watch the movie, he's not the best. He's good, but he's definitely not the best driver in that film. Same with James Garner in Grand Prix. He's not the best driver in that film. So he has to drag something special out of himself to be the hero that everybody wants him to be at the end of the film. What's really interesting is that Town and Scott and Bruckheimer and Cruise have obviously all got together, figured out that that's something that happens in the racing world. You know, they've kind of studied the racing world and how the characters and how the drivers actually are and how they behave, and then dragged that narrative into how they sculpt the movie around him. It's incredibly intelligent.
There is an anecdote that Cole kind of recounts about how his father exploited him and shafted him. And that's really the only personal backstory.
We don't know anything about
him. We don't know anything about this guy.
That's it.
He just kind of, he rides in on his motorcycle like a sort of figure from the middle.
Is that bit in slow motion? Because it feels like it is.
I think it is.
It's not quite. The smoke, he just rides sort of through the smoke, which slowly definitely hits that it might be slow-mo.
It is a great, because they say, well, who is this new driver? And they all sort of turn and look off screen. You hear this kind of EastEnders style music.
Yeah.
And he comes in and there's smoke and his gorgeous hair is billowing. And I think, oh, it's going to be that kind of film. And thankfully it isn't.
No, it's quite funny because the guy who's there in the car testing before that is Michael Rooker.
Yeah.
Mr. Machismo.
Love Michael Rooker. Hollywood. Really love
him. Mr. Macho.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks like a NASCAR driver from the moment you see him on screen. You don't even think for a moment, oh, he's an actor playing a NASCAR driver.
Yeah.
No, he's just taken on that persona. He's so good, Michael Rooker. Again, very underrated. He just exudes it from the moment that you see him on screen. And then you suddenly see, well, here comes this young upstart on a motorbike. Who the hell does this guy think he is?
The casting is great.
Oh, it's spot on.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Duvall's character, he is perfect in that sort of mentor, where they have that kind of cheeky, slightly antagonistic relationship. And he really doesn't have any faith in Cruz's character at first until Cruz sort of looks at him earnestly and says, let me drive, I will make a fool out of you. And it's almost like he falls in love with them at that point.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's what everyone wants to hear. But Michael Rooker, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've written here, under my notes for Michael Rooker, I've put he's the dependable, grumpy frenemy.
And
he plays that great in
almost every role.
In every role, absolutely, yeah.
Guardians of the Galaxy, whatever name it.
Cliffhanger is absolutely spot on. And for this, he's just perfectly cast.
Yeah, not so much in Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, but
he's very grumpy.
He has got a mate, isn't that? One thing I was quite surprised to find in my research, aka reading Wikipedia and IMDb, was how many characters and incidents in this film were based on real life.
Yeah.
So, you know, Cole Trickle, the character of Cole Trickle, and I do have to say,
what we have to mention it, don't we? We have to mention the name.
A Cole Trickle. Sounds like a prostate issue.
And I think Tom Cruise gave himself that name. It's pretty.
This is really interesting because, of course, he is based on a real-life racing driver called Tim Richmond, who properly had a weird journey in NASCAR and was very, very colourful. They looked at his character and thought, you know what, this guy's interesting. So we're going to kind of base it loosely around him. What's baffling about the name Cole Trickle, it's kind of a nod to another driver on the grid in those days whose name was Dick Trickle. So how close did we come? You can't even write that.
No.
You can't even write
that. No one would believe it.
No, absolutely. So I think they kind of had to make it slightly believable by adapting the name. But that is genuinely what the guy's name was. And you would never mock him about it in front of him because that guy was hard as nails.
Yeah, I can imagine. You did not. You'd have to be with a name like Dick Trickle.
Which isn't a joke that you would do in front of him, saying he's hard as nails.
No, indeed. No. You definitely wouldn't do that joke in front of him.
But even Duval's character was based on, you know, a well-known figure of NASCAR.
Indeed it was. Yep, Harry Hyde, who was very well respected and well loved in NASCAR.
Randy Quaid's character had a real life analogue.
Oh yeah, Rick Hendrick. Rick Hendrick is the guy who masterminded Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, all the major NASCAR players of the last sort of 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
It's funny because, essentially he was a car dealer turned racing car fanatic. Amazing how he did it.
Amazing.
And some of the incidents, like, you know, when Michael Rooker and Tom Cruise race rental cars against each other. That was based
happened.
On... real incidents.
Genuinely happened.
The whole eating ice cream. I got a pit! You can't.
That also happened in real life in NASCAR. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So this is the level of research that Tom Cruise is good at. You know, yeah. He falls head over heels in love with a project and he really goes into his research.
Yeah.
So the attention to detail is always on point. And it's fabulous because racing is one of those sports where if you didn't see it happen in front of you, you wouldn't believe it was possible. So the reason that the Rush film is so spectacular is because the story is insane. You know, nobody would ever have believed that a guy could be burnt at the flames of a racing car crash and then, you know, 5 weeks later be back behind the wheel and still challenging for a world championship. It's not possible. It's superhuman. They actually said at the time, you know, there's no way you could ever make a movie about this because no one would believe you. There are some baffling things that happen in the sport, and they've taken just some of the more random incidents in NASCAR in the 80s and thought, you know what, this is so funny, we're going to put it into the movie, including the scene where they got pulled over by the police and a highway patrol officer turned out to be a hooker.
That scene might be real, but there was something that was definitely a prosthetic in that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if you saw it. Hold on for a few frames.
Do you know what? I wasn't looking in that much detail, but if you're going to write a movie about yourself, then you may as well give yourself as much license as humanly possible.
It's like a rolling pin in his jeans.
It was a bit, yeah. Even as a sort of, you know, when I watched it a few times back as a teenager and you start going through puberty and you're thinking about those sort of things, you go, what a crock. I tell you, one of my favourites that I really wish would end up in a movie someday. This is a slight deviation, but in the 20s, Grand Prix racing was chaotic, absolutely farcical. You know, it was basically just a bunch of wealthy amateurs who would turn up to a car. You never knew who was going to turn up until the race started. And there was a famous incident at the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa, 1925. There were two cars left in the race with over half of it left to go. And they were both from the same team, Alfa Romeo. And the crowd got really irate about it and started throwing things at them. You know, they were furious, angry. It's like, this isn't a race. This isn't an entertainment. We've wasted a day to come and watch you two cars parade around. And they were 15 minutes apart from each other around the track as well. So it's not even like they were racing each other. So the boss of Alfa Romeo was so incensed that the crowd would have a go at him like that he waved the leader into the pits. Come in. Waved the leader in. 15 minutes later, he waved the second guy in, because it's the same team, into the pits. They put up a table and they set up a picnic and they ate lunch in the pits.
That's amazing.
Right in front of the main grandstand.
That's so
this
good.
Is the kind of stuff that happens in our sport. You know, you would not believe some of the stuff that has actually happened, which is why Driven with Sylvester Stallone, his story was fantastic in the same way that Days of Thunder was. But you should never let the producers and the director get their hands on something that's beautiful like that, because what Rennie Harlin and the Warner Brothers people did with Driven was ruin it. Fortunately, Tom Cruise was a real stick in the mud and said, no, this is how the movie's got to be told. This is how it's got to be done. We've got to show it as it was written. And it's the same with, you know, people like Tony Scott and Jerry Bruckheimer. You don't cross them. If they want to tell a story, they're going to tell the story the way that they need to tell it. I'm so glad that they had, you know, strong-willed, you know, really, really resourceful people to tell this story. But there were massive delays. You know, when most movies are supposed to have, like, 5 months to try and get a film from its finished product to the editing stage to release stage, you know, Days of Thunder didn't have 5 months. They had 5 weeks, which is baffling when you think about it. They managed to edit down everything to a finished product in 5 weeks rather than the regular 5 months that you get. That's astonishing.
They started without even a completed script. And they were writing things on the day.
I did read somewhere that they wrapped and then they realised that they'd forgotten to shoot the finish of the final race.
Absolutely true.
Would have been great if they'd done like a little miniature or something.
Or just cut the crowd going, hooray! He won!
I do sometimes wonder if Talladega Nights suffered from the same problem.
Yeah.
Maybe. That's me just putting it out.
But it was quite a troubled
It was very excessive.
It was very excessive. Don Simpson and probably in the height of his excesses.
Yes, absolutely.
And I read somewhere that he actually wanted to have quite a large supporting role.
Yeah.
But
he did.
Tony Scott sort of almost sabotaged it by filming his worst performances and showing it on the dailies. And they all agree that they had to cut that way down. But Don Simpson and Bruckheimer and Tony Scott and Robert Towne were clashing quite a bit, I think.
Yeah. I think the budget doubled.
The budget doubled. It was a financial success. So it made about 157 mil. Mm. But, I mean, that's dwarfed in comparison to Top Gun, which made sort of an excess of, I think, 360 million, something like that.
Yeah.
So the relative failure of this put an end to the partnership between Simpson and Bruckheimer and Paramount. And they say that it kind of ended that era of the producer powerhouse team calling the shots.
Because that had been the case since, I think, something like Heaven's Gate, where those auto directors of the 70s.
Yeah.
They did whatever the hell they wanted, and obviously Heaven's Gate pretty much killed United Artists.
Yeah.
And this was the end of that for producers, and then obviously since then, the director kind of is king now. You know, you go and see a Christopher Nolan film, or you go and see whatever. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, you're right, they did say that this was the start of that, really.
The end of an era and a start of a new one.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing as well is that, you know, they were trying to do all of this multi-million dollar production with strong-willed people in the middle of a NASCAR season.
Yeah.
I mean, when you go into a racetrack at that level, you are walking into a military operation. It is insane, the level of legislation, paperwork, insurance, money, safety regulations, protocols that you have to be dabbling with while the race is going on if you want to film up that close. It's crazy. Mm. I still think to this day the greatest racing film that's ever been made is Grand Prix. It was made in an era when none of that stuff existed. So you'll never ever get that close to the action ever again.
Yeah,
because it would
be
pure suicide to even contemplate it. As a result, you know, before all of these rules and restrictions and legislations were in place, there's only so much you can do. There's only so much, so close you can get. I hear that Brad Pitt and Lewis Hamilton have signed up to do a new Formula One project with Apple. I am terrified at how bad it's going to be. I'm not joking. I'm terrified at how bad it's going to be because there's only a certain limit to how close you can get to these things. How you fill in the gap whilst also titillating your audience. I mean, Driven is a perfect case in point. You then just start making crashes that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And you start using CGI that isn't ready. I mean, the CGI they used in Driven, it would embarrass walking with dinosaurs. It's so bored. It's so bad. You have to keep the realism as close to it as possible. And I do think that Days of Thunder was the last movie that really got that close and nailed it.
Yeah.
Absolutely nailed it. And I think it's the last great, true to the experience of motor racing film that we'll ever see, which is one of the reasons I love it, because it is the last one. Everything since then, you're just basically dealing with corporate lawyers and legislation and protocol, and you can't get that close ever again.
I think, you know, Tony Scott is key to providing that impact that certainly the action scenes have. You know, I mean, Tony Scott, often unloved by critics, but hugely influential stylistically. Obviously, his style was sort of rooted in commercials and music videos, sort of flashy shots, that heightened lighting, there's sort of lots of blurs, sort of a slickness to things, but at the same time, an extreme, almost kind of verite approach to action, where you can kind of feel the dust and the smoke.
It's very sweaty
film. Very sweat.
Yeah.
And that kind of frenetic editing. And in a way, Michael Bay is kind of like his bastard son, who has kind of given that style a bad name. But Tony Scott, I mean, he's made some great films. You know, I mean, The Hunger, True Romance, Crimson Tide, Enemy of the State.
Mm.
Spy Game was actually one of my favourite films when it came out. I'd love to actually revisit it for this podcast.
I'm in.
But he just brings such style and intensity to it. Mm. And I was never bored. Before I watched this, I was like, am I going to get a bit bored with watching the cars driving around?
Yeah.
I wasn't bored. And, you know, the scenes are kind of short. The dialogue's really pared back. I mean, it's dripping with testosterone.
Mm.
But you kind of know that going in. I know that there was a lot of behind-the-scenes struggle between him and the producers and Robert Town, but I just think what Tony Scott brought to this has leveled it up.
Absolutely. I mean, the lasting legacy of this movie within the motor racing industry as a whole is quite astonishing. I've been working in the sport now for 10 years. It's a fairy tale when you start working in it when you are a fan. You know, you cannot even comprehend the kind of stuff that you get to do. You befriend a lot of people within the sport, a lot of drivers, a lot of team bosses, a lot of mechanics, a lot of engineers, a lot of press people, media people. And it's quite funny when you start talking to people and you become friendly with them in the sport of racing and you kind of say, well, I just want to hang out tonight. I just want to put on a film or something. And you say, what film are you going to put on? 9 times out of 10, it's going to be Days of Thunder. And that doesn't matter what form of racing you're into, because there'll be Formula One fans who will love watching Senna, will love watching Rush, who will like watching Grand Prix. You've got sports car fans who love the recent Le Mans 66 or Ford versus Ferrari with Matt Damon and Christian Bale. Love that movie.
Mm.
Very, very well told. Very beautifully constructed. You could be a rally fan. You could be a NASCAR fan. You could be a karting fan. It doesn't matter. And in Britain, nobody knows what NASCAR is, really. Nobody really gets it. We don't have coverage of NASCAR in the UK because it's not relevant to us. Formula One is relevant to us. The British Touring Car Championship is relevant to us. We don't watch NASCAR, but we do watch Days of Thunder if we like fast cars, because that's just the film that is the epitome. It's got something for everybody, which is what I like about it. And this is the thing. If you're a motor racing movie, you've got to try and convince people who are not into racing cars that it's a great sport. You have to find a way to do it. And the way they've done it is amazing. The sport looks realistic. It feels and smells off the screen. You can kind of feel what it's like being in that garage. There's enough play-by-play between Cruz, Kidman, Duval, Quaid to keep you interested when the racing isn't happening. It still grabs you. You kind of want to see where the story's going to go. You don't love the characters. You kind of have to work at it, but you laugh at the bravado. You laugh at the machismo. You know, it's a fun film. And then it gets serious. And then you do kind of see where the story's going to go. You do want to see how things develop. The English people, when Kerry Elwes comes up on screen, it's the traitor. Here he comes.
Yeah.
Here he comes. The traitor who sold out for Hollywood. Yes, we remember you in Robin Hood Men in Tights, and you did a great English accent because you're English, but... However, you know, you're still the traitor, which is great because he is the bad guy.
He's got
in this movie,
such a punchable face on this movie,
Kerry Elwes. He does. It also doesn't help if we're talking about the comparisons of this and Top Gun.
Yeah.
He really looks like Iceman.
He does.
Which is so funny because then obviously he played that character
in
Hot
Shots.
Shots.
Yeah.
It's absolutely perfect. So, yeah, it literally has something for everyone. You can even have the long suffering. Brothers and sisters and mothers and grandparents of people within racing will sit and watch Days of Thunder with the absolute petrol head obsessed, because there's something in there to watch. It's enjoyable. It's fun. It's never going to be the greatest movie, drama, sports movie, action movie. There are so many better ones out there. But in terms of rubbing the pleasure zones of the petrol head, it really does tick all of the appropriate boxes. It's spot on.
But I think, like all above average sports films, it's not about sport. It's about the characters. Mm-hmm. It's about the rise and fall and rise again. And like I said, him acknowledging his failings and getting to grips with that. It's about the relationships with other people. It's about the rivalry. It's about all of that. It just so happens that there's some really fun racing going on as part of it too.
Mm.
And I think that's the key.
I have read how influential this has been on NASCAR as a sport as well. Because it would be fair to say, Jake, that in 1990, NASCAR was still something of a, it's kind of like a regional sport. Hadn't really hit major mainstream interest at that point.
Yeah, that's a fair thing to say. It was just starting to brew the corporate bubble. It was just starting to get there. So obviously, corporate America adores NASCAR. It absolutely loves it. And it only really started to accelerate in traction at about sort of mid to late 70s, when you had people like Earnhardt, Allison, all of these incredible superstars coming through. And that's what makes NASCAR incredible. It's not the racing, it's the characters.
Yeah.
You know, everyone in America knows who Richard Petty is. That's corporate America. That's power, you know? Yeah. That's something that is really, really difficult to replicate. There's only a handful of sports like the NBA, World Heavyweight Boxing, the NFL, that can do that in America. And NASCAR can do that. And this movie was amazing for that, because you kind of got similar sort of vibes from the characters in that you do in real NASCAR. It was very well constructed, very well devised. And yeah, Days of Thunder is still very affectionately remembered by the people in America and worldwide. I mean, you get these sort of video game modders now who like to do sort of tributes to famous racing cars and whatever. In NASCAR games, there will always be a replica of all of the cars that were featured in the Days of Thunder movie every single time. That will be the first car that anyone designs. So there is still a massive homage to it. And even Talladega Nights references Days of Thunder in it. You know, that's
how casting John C. Reilly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, John C. Reilly is in both, which is a part of it. But, you know, that fabulous, ridiculous scene where Will Ferrell believes he's on fire. You know, he screams, help me, Jesus, help me, Tom Cruise. Still part of the NASCAR culture. I mean, this movie was made 32 years ago, or released 32 years ago, and they're still talking about it.
Yeah.
And even more so than things like Stroker Ace or Talladega Nights is seen as like the funny movie in NASCAR. Oh, it's a bit of a laugh. The one that people really look back on and go, yeah, that's what NASCAR's really about, Days of Thunder.
Yeah, they'll go for a trickle over a stroker anytime.
They certainly will go for a trickle over a stroker, yeah.
But I feel like we do need to give honourable mention to Nicole Kidman.
She's in it, yeah.
Yeah. She's doing the Kelly McGillis.
Yeah.
She's supposed to be sort of a bit serious, professional, all about business, resisting the unstoppable charm and charisma of Tom Cruise until she can no longer.
Yeah, well, she's only human.
Yeah. Well, her acting in it was phenomenal, actually.
She's good, yeah.
It was really nice as well to see that she used her original Australian accent.
Yeah, it's very early on.
And her original face.
And her original hair. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And her original face. Good point.
She's still got that sort of sideshow bob frizzy hair going on as well. Because this is really early on in her career, where I think she had essentially only done Australian films.
Dead Calm, which was amazing. Yeah. Which I think
that was prior to this, and BMX Bandits, obviously. Yeah. and then after that, she, of course, went Hollywood and left her accent behind. But it's a good performance. It's great.
I did read that she wanted to study neurosurgery for this, and the producers basically said, nah.
We don't have the budget for that.
No. We're a waste of time.
We can't spare any patients, sorry.
But that tells you a lot about her style as an actor. You know, if she's going to do something, if she's going to play a particular person, then she really wants to nail it, which is a real sign of professionalism.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just turn up and say the lines and take your paycheck and go home.
Yeah.
But the fact that she actually wanted to study what she was talking about so that she could really get it right, that should not be underestimated in, you know, modern Hollywood. And fair play to her. You can even see that the chemistry actually works. It's not phony. It's not staged. Mm. You can see that the chemistry between them from the start is real.
Mm.
And it's not really a surprise that they actually ended up married. You can really see that, you know, they properly... You can kind of tell when the chemistry is kind of staged in a movie. You can kind of see, you know, this isn't quite believable. You wouldn't really put those two together. But with these two, it's very natural. It's very, very easy. Even just subtle moments when they're walking to the race car and he's about to climb in. Subtle little moments, little gestures where she puts the hand on the shoulder and everything. You don't need to do that in acting. You definitely don't need to kind of have that. Nobody would notice it. But it's just little subtle behavioural characteristics between them. You can see that there's a spark.
There's that scene where she throws him against the wall and sort of nibbles at his face and looks like she's about to bite his face off.
Yeah. So. Very interesting. I'm not sure how I would handle it if my wife came at me like that, to be honest.
But it's funny that you mentioned Tom Cruise sort of getting in out of the vehicle, because every time his pit crew pull him out of the car, it just reminded me of getting my toddler out of the car seat. Because he looks so little.
I know. Yeah.
It did
make me laugh. This is really cruel. It did make me laugh where he's trying to chat up Nicole Kidman on the phone and he says, "How tall are you?" And I thought, oh, that's a shape of things to come, isn't it? You
know? Yeah. Well, these days he'd be...
He'd have got no heels.
Yeah, these days he'd be called a short king. That's the latest thing, you know, the whole kind of Zendaya, Tom Holland thing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he's a short king. For all the short kings out there.
He certainly is a short king. Absolutely. Yeah.
My daughters are absolutely obsessed with the whole Tom Holland Zendaya thing. I didn't really think that was going to enter into this at any point. It's amazing. I tried a podcast to get away from my kids for 5 seconds and they bounce back. They're amazing.
He's one of my daughter's crushes, Tom Holland. Yeah, she likes him.
Mine as well. Yep. My daughter's as well. Yeah.
Well, I just saw that behind the scenes bit of him from No Way Home where he's running along the freeway and jumps on a trampoline, does a little flip, and I kind of got a crush on him after that too. I didn't...
It's quite easy.
That was pretty cool.
It's quite interesting that my daughter's got a crush on him because, as you know, she's got unusual sort of morbid tastes.
Yeah.
I think he's one of her only crushes who's actually still alive. she loves River Phoenix.
Yeah.
She loves Jonathan Landis.
Heath Ledger, I would have thought. Heath Ledger.
She's not a fan of Heath Ledger. Not yet, anyway. She's only 11. Give her time.
My partner had a bit of a Heath Ledger thing.
He was cool.
When I was younger, I grew my hair longer, you see. I had to. I had no choice. I was told. It's good.
But how'd you get those scars?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's another podcast, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, pardon the pun, we could probably cut to the chase here, couldn't we?
Yeah, we probably could.
I think we already know the answer, but we will ask you, Jake. Do you think that Days of Thunder is still any good?
It's an interesting question because you really can see that the film has aged. It's funny because there are certain films that are timeless. But yeah, I think the film has kind of aged. And there are elements of it that NASCAR definitely want to deviate away from.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of want to forget it happened, almost. Certainly the way that the drivers behave now, and nothing like the way that the drivers are portrayed in this movie. Never. And if they do, NASCAR come down on them very hard.
Yeah.
It's definitely of its time, but I do think it's the last great movie about racing cars where you can actually get that close to them.
Yeah.
You've seen, there have been a lot of attempts recently where people have tried. And I think Rush is the closest. They did very, very well to kind of get back all of the old cars from the 1970s. They ran collectors and see, you know, can we stage these races again and refilm them, as well as taking original footage. And Le Mans 66, oh, God bless them. They did the best they really could with the racing sequences. But any petrolhead will tell you that the racing sequences themselves are awful. Mm-hmm. The movie acting and the play-by-play, Christian Bale and Matt Damon, was phenomenal. You really did believe. And I've met Carroll Shelby. I'm very proud to say I actually met Carroll Shelby. Mm-hmm. Matt Damon nailed him. Absolutely nailed him without any shadow of doubt. Spot on, perfect. With Days of Thunder, it does stand the test of time. I think it's one of the great Tom Cruise acting performances that everyone's forgotten, because he is believable. Yes, he is known for being Tom Cruise in a Tom Cruise movie doing Tom Cruise stunts. But with Days of Thunder, he really pushed his own boundaries. It's a shame that it's forgotten to a certain extent, because it was, I think, one of his great acting performances. It's definitely up there with Magnolia, with Minority Report, with Jerry Maguire. I think it's right up there as one of his finest efforts. So yeah, I think the movie's still great. There are definite holes in it, and, you know, petrolheads kind of smile and go, yeah, it's all right, it's Days of Thunder. It kind of gets a free pass. There are other movies that get it very, very wrong that people just, you know, I'm not owning that. It's embarrassing. The vibe is right. Mm. The essence of the sport is right. And that's the hardest thing to get right.
Okay,
cool.
Right. See, I shouldn't have liked this. I was ready to not like this. Almost despite myself, I really enjoyed it. I'm probably slightly less effusive about Tom Cruise's performance. Like, I think it's a perfectly fine performance. But for me, it's like the sum of all the parts, like the supporting roles. Like, love Robert Duvall, love the dynamic between him and Cruise, love Michael Rooker, even, you know, Randy Quaid. They add a lot of texture to it.
Yeah.
You know, yes, Nicole Kidman's a pretty thankless role, but I just think by about the second or third minute of the film, I just relaxed into, I knew exactly what this was going to be like.
Yeah.
I just went along for the ride, no pun intended. You know, and I thought, as mentioned before, the reality, the heightened reality that Tony Scott sort of brings to it with the action on the track, that sort of sweaty, dusty kind of realism. Yeah, I was just, it swept me along, didn't bore me. I enjoyed it. So, I have to say, it's good. I'm kind of glad that I haven't seen it, you know, in the 32 years since it's been made, because it was like a nice little surprise for me.
It's like stepping back in time to an almost forgotten era of movie making, isn't it?
Yeah.
That sort of mid to late 80s, early 90s of, this is going to be a bit flamboyant. This is going to be a little bit over the top. And it's going to be very clichéd.
Yeah.
And the whole movie is a cliché, right from the start to the finish. It is an absolute walking, talking, moving cliché. But the reason we have these clichés is because they're still kind of good.
If you don't fight it, if you just kind of go with it,
absolutely.
You can have a good time.
As long as you don't go in expecting The Godfather or something, then absolutely, yeah.
It is pure testosterone on screen from the start to the end.
Dripping with it.
The gender politics
dripping
are skewed. They are very backwards. Yeah. Nicole Kidman kind of goes with it because, hey, I might get a career if I go through this.
And she did.
But she did, you know. And it's funny, you know, the lasting legacy and impact of it amongst racing folk is extraordinary. I mean, I still see TikTokers who are like 11, 12, 13-year-old kart racers and their fellow rivals and everything. When they're getting ready for a race, and they do the obligatory, you know, doing up of the suit, putting on the gloves, putting on the helmet and everything. A lot of the time, the music they will choose is that opening music that you get right at the very start of the movie. That sort of building of tension, that building of spectacle. That's the thing we haven't really talked about as well, but that soundtrack by Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
I mean, when has Hans Zimmer delivered a bad soundtrack? Can you think of one? Because I can't think of one where Hans Zimmer hasn't created something that is iconic years later. It kind of attaches itself to the film, but Hans Zimmer is so good at nailing the essence of any project he's in. And he totally gets, he obviously looked at NASCAR and went, you know, this is pomp, this is circumstance, this is brass bands, this is corporate America. It needs to be fast, audacious, over the top, extreme, extravagant. He nailed it. It's absolutely spot on.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have thought the guy that scored Chris Nolan's kind of films with all their sort of...
yeah.
would be this guy.
I was going to go with the theme for Going for Gold.
And do you know what's funny about it as well is that Hans Zimmer did the soundtrack for this, but he was then called up again by Ron Howard to do the score for Rush. So he clearly figured something in that and went, do you know what? This guy clearly knows what he's doing here in getting the sort of the essence of the energy and the excitement. But it's a completely different score. It's a completely different environment. Again, he's managed to create it. And that's iconic as well. It's astonishing.
So, 2 out of 3. Goods. Mm. That ain't bad.
That ain't bad.
Chris?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Very much like you, I didn't think I would.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly because, as I mentioned before, I'd seen the trailer so many times. And the trailer doesn't really do it much of a service. The trailer really sells Tom Cruise as, oh, he's brilliant. There's all those, there's nothing I can't do with a race car. All these lines all the way through it. There's no sign of his kind of, his fallibility or his weakness or any of it. Or the fact that him saying that is his arrogance. It just sells him as just being amazing. I thought, oh, it's just going to be absolute cheese. And I was very pleased that it wasn't. We'll do another Top Gun comparison. I'm not a fan of Top Gun. I find it way too gung-ho and flag-wavy and woo!
I agree.
This is better.
Yeah.
This is better than Top Gun. Controversial there. So as you said, it's cookie-cutter character development, but I like it. You go along with it. I think it's fun. The Michael Rooker character is awesome. Of the flaws, I don't like the way that they just drop Michael Rooker's character sort of at the end of Act 2. He goes in for brain surgery and we don't see or hear from him again.
Yeah.
No, they don't even wheel him out for the final one, you know, and come and say hello. So presumably his whole family are now destitute because that was what he was living on. And that's a bit too much of a depressing story. So, but he's just replaced by another rival. They bring in Russ Wheeler at exactly the same time. And I felt that was a little bit imbalanced.
That's a good point because Russ Wheeler has bought him quite late, hasn't
he? He is, yeah. They get rid of Michael Rooker and they bring in Keri Ruse.
Keri Elwes.
Yes.
Yeah.
They just cross over. It's just like a relay.
Yeah.
Mm. It's like tag team. I didn't like the Hans Zimmer score. I'm sorry.
You didn't like it?
No, but were you talking about the reasons that he did it that way? That's probably why, because to me it felt kind of very, very cheesy. It felt sort of mid-80s. Yeah. It felt noisy. It felt a bit... Oh no, this
felt Top Gun.
It felt Top Gun. It felt... And I thought, oh God. But so I wasn't a fan, but you sort of excusing it, it's almost giving it a bit of a pass, to be honest. And I was like, oh, I see why he's done that now.
I mean, amongst racing folk, it kind of fits. It kind of fits the vibe. It is a little bit cheesy. It is a little bit cliched. And the lines that we still talk about from Days of Thunder to this day to the next, it's funny. You know, people will try desperately not to crowbar Robin is racing into race commentary. Even I've done it a couple of times.
So
it's terrible. It's terrible. But the reason that the cliche is there is because it's iconic. It'll last forever.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I have met a couple of drivers who have said there's nothing I can't do in a race car. So you just know how arrogant they are.
Absolutely.
So it's great.
Yeah.
They've clearly nicked it.
I think there are a lot more positives than negatives.
Yeah.
I think it looks great. The photography is really, really good. The editing is really, really special. The sound mix is fantastic.
It was Oscar nominated.
It was Oscar nominated, really crunchy, just roaring.
Mm.
Just this real noise. Me, like most other British people, have absolutely no idea really about NASCAR. Like most Brits, we just go, oh, it's just going round and round. It's not real skill, is it? It doesn't matter. In a sport like this, you know whoever crosses the finish line first is the winner. It's not like where you watch a baseball movie and they go, oh my God, there's only 3 left and he's on the 9. I have no idea what they're talking about. So I just lose interest immediately. With this, it's first past the post wins the race. I can understand that. That's fine. So even though I know nothing about NASCAR, doesn't matter. Mm. It's fine. You can get on board. You can support the winner. You can boo the baddie or the loser, whatever. That's fine. So I thought it was really, really fun. I was really shocked when you said, oh, it's 32 years old. Of course it is. It was 1990.
Mm.
But to me, it doesn't feel that way. I thought this was kind of a later, more mature Tom Cruise performance. I didn't realise how young and childlike he is in it, because he doesn't appear that way.
He's very bow-faced, isn't he?
It feels like much later on in the career. So I was interested how young everybody was in it as well.
I love what you mentioned about NASCAR, because it's so funny. The American comedian Jeff Dunham describes NASCAR very simply. He said, it's an easy sport to follow when you're hammered.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant, because most of the spectators are, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Well, that's three goods.
I know, we're doing well, aren't
we? Yeah, we're doing well. Yeah. I have to say, it's been really cool having a guest on who's also like got a uniquely subject matter expertise on kind of the movie that we've been doing as well.
We've been outstated.
It's like watching Madagascar and having David Attenborough on or something.
Having a lion. Oh, he's going on next.
I'll take that comparison to the bank and run with it forever.
So, Jake, thank you. That was good. We enjoyed the film and really enjoyed the chat.
It's been a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure.
And where can our listeners find you online?
So you can find me either at Jake Sanson or at Jake Sanson Official, depending on what social media you carry. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, if you really want to be embarrassed. TikTok's fantastic. You can either be one of three things on TikTok, young, sexy, or fashionable, and I'm none of those three, so I just have my own form of TikTok. So I'm just weird and random. That's what my TikTok looks like. You can find me in various different places. Watch race coverage. Type my name into Google, and I'll probably pop up looking very, very unusual and very odd. And my voice probably won't have as many vocal cords as it currently does, because I get very, very excited about my racing. Very excited.
That's great.
That's the way to be. Absolutely.
No, it's been awesome having you on. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for allowing me to come on. It's been great.
Let's do a little bit of housekeeping. So if you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook. And if you want to email us, it's StillAnyGood@gmail.com. And please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from. Enjoy Portugal.
I will. Yeah, thank you. It's just stopped raining, so that's perfect timing.
And we will see you all again soon, folks.
See you later.
Thanks very much. Bye.